Shabbat Shalom.
Shabbat Shalom.
In the 1860s, Charles Baudelaire wrote this in his journal. It's impossible to glance through any newspaper, no matter what the day, without finding on every line the most frightful traces of human perversity. Every newspaper, from the first line to the last, is nothing but a tissue of horrors. Wars, crimes, thefts, evil deeds of nations, of private individuals, an orgy of universal atrocity. And it is with this loathsome appetizer that civilized man washes down his morning repast. It's still the case. We are numbed by the deluge of suffering we are exposed to on a daily basis through television, print, social media, the wars, savagery, brutality, illness, economic dislocation desensitize us. We can still muster some righteous indignation when we view on our screens one individual person struggling to breathe under the knee of another. But it is much more difficult to summon the same moral indignation over millions struggling to breathe, their lungs hardened by this awful virus. Susan Sontag wrote a short book entitled Regarding the Pain of Others. In it, she argued that we want our pain to be regarded as unique. It is intolerable, she writes, to have one's suffering twinned with anyone else's suffering. My suffering is real. Her suffering is not so bad. She can bear the burden. She can tolerate it. Mel Brooks captured the essence of this when he joked, "Tragedy is when I cut my finger. Comedy is when you fall into an open sewer and die." And thus, as Sontag asserted, compassion is an unstable emotion. It needs to be translated into action, or else it withers. Constant exposure to the pain of others desensitizes us. If we are to build a better world, a more peaceful, prosperous, and just society, if we are to rectify past injustices, to relieve the pain of others, to give dignity to the oppressed, to set the nation and humanity on an upward trajectory of moral progress, we must focus not only or even primarily on another's pain, rather, we must focus on our remedial action. Compassion is not enough. It is an unstable emotion. It needs to be translated into deeds. This is classic Judaism. Piety is in performance. Good intentions are desirable, but good outcomes are required. Action is the result of every sound philosophy. If all you do is sigh in pity as you read the paper and wash down your daily repast, well, pity is an unstable emotion. An hour later, You're into your daily routine, dealing with your own problems. Compassion must be translated into deeds. This week's Torah portion, Bahar, contains one of the most profound passages in the history of civilization. The Bible describes the exultant announcement of the arrival of the Jubilee year. Blow the shofar on the 10th day of the 7th month, on Yom Kippur. You will blow the shofar. You shall sanctify the 50th year and proclaim liberty throughout the land unto all the inhabitants thereof. That is the verse carved into the Liberty Bell in Philadelphia. Every 50 years, a general release was proclaimed. All Hebrew slaves, they were not the slaves of Egypt, they were indentured servants who sold themselves to their debtors to pay off their debts. All of these indentured servants were set free. All debts were forgiven. Ownership of property was restored to the original owner or his family. But typical of our tradition, the rabbis perceived a problem. When does the Jubilee year actually begin, they asked. Does it begin on the 10th day of the month, on Yom Kippur, as the Torah seems to suggest? Or does the Jubilee year start when all years start, on the first day of the year? The first day of the year, 10 days before Yom Kippur, is what holiday? There you go. That's the beginning of the month, the beginning of the year, Rosh Hashanah. So the rabbis say, why would the Jubilee year start on the 10th day of the month and not the first day of the month? Don't all years start on the first of the year? Start January 1st on January 10th? Was there something about the Jubilee year that upended the normal calendar? The question itself seems rather pedantic, because who really cares? Once in 50 years, start counting on the first of the month or 10 days later, what difference does a week and a half make? But the sages were focusing on something profound. If you were a slave, those 10 days mattered to you. The Talmud eventually concluded that the Jubilee year begins on Rosh Hashanah, the first day of the month of Tishrei. Of course, they said, that's when the year starts, the first of the year. But how then to resolve the contradiction that the Torah mandates sounding the shofar, proclaiming the beginning of the Jubilee year on Yom Kippur, the 10th of the month? Rabbi Ishmael taught, the Jubilee year begins on Rosh Hashanah, the first day of the year. However, the slaves were not actually released until the 10th of the year, when the shofar was sounded on Yom Kippur. In other words, the indentured servants were released from servitude on the first day of the year, but did not actually leave their masters' homes and go back to their families until 10 days later, on Yom Kippur. It's an elegant solution. No, it's typical of a rabbinic mode of thinking. You probably didn't think of it yourselves, but rabbis do. So that resolves all the issues, right? Not a chance. The end of a Talmudic discussion is never the end of a Talmudic discussion. The rabbis further inquire, well, if the servants were released from work on Rosh Hashanah, but were unable to leave their master's home until Yom Kippur, what were they doing for 10 days? What were they doing? Anyone? What were they doing for 10 days? I'm glad you asked. In a beautiful and moving statement, the sages teach, they ate, they drank, and they rejoiced, and would wear crowns on their heads as if they were free people. What a glorious scene. Picture that in your mind. Before being released from what might have been decades of servitude, everyone spent 10 days feasting and celebrating. Both the servants and their masters were on equal footing. Why? This was society's way to reset the relationship that was damaged in the years of servitude, and to translate our responsibility for the shame and humiliation of others into actions restoring the dignity of those who sold themselves to pay off their debts. Before they left their master's homes, they sat down with their former overseers as equals. They wore crowns to symbolize that they were free people. All human beings are entitled to freedom and dignity. Economic dislocation, soul-crushing debts, poverty, unemployment offend human dignity. If you are economically troubled, and even if it was your own fault, if you yourself are responsible, if you yourself are to blame for your economic situation, you caused it, you took reckless risks, still, you are entitled to release and restoration. You cannot be permanently confined by society to economic pain and misery. Human dignity requires restoring the balance. We cannot have a system that perpetually locks in economic disadvantage and that permanently enshrines an economic ruling class and an economic underclass. Not only would that be bad politics, it would be a violation of all that Judaism holds dear. It is an assault on the dignity of fellow human beings. Liberty is the point of the Jubilee. They got that right. That's why they carved that book, that verse, into the Liberty Bill. It would be a violation of everything we know if we were to neglect this central obligation of liberty. One nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all, requires those who have to exercise responsibilities to those who do not have. That's why the Jubilee is such an important concept in Judaism. Regarding the pain of others, those who are in less pain must exercise actionable compassion towards those who are in more pain. We must seek to restore the balance of dignity, even if we know the task cannot be fully completed. If all we do is think, how lamentable are the world's daily horrors while washing down our morning repast? This is fake, artificial, empty compassion, the kind that America loves, that our self-help gurus assure us, render us as virtuous people. Religion is much tougher on us, which may be one reason why most prefer the gospel of happiness and the preachers of self-improvement. Judaism commands that we translate compassion into deeds. And when this happens, sympathy, pity, mercy are transported from the workings of the heart and translated into the hard work of social repair.